Welcome to This Month in Muscular Dystrophy. I'm Kevin Flanagan from the Center for Gene Therapy at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Each month on this podcast, we invite authors of recent publications to discuss how their work improves our understanding of inherited neuromuscular diseases and what their work might mean for the treatment of these diseases. Today, it's my great pleasure to speak once again to Dr. Jerry Mendell, who holds the Curran Peters Chair and is professor of pediatrics at The Ohio State University. He's also director of the Center for Gene Therapy and director of the Senator Paul Wellstone Muscular Dystrophy Research Center at Nationwide Children's. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
We're going to discuss today the recent paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, just published in October, and I'll remind our listeners that there's a link on our webpage that leads you to the abstract of this paper. The paper is entitled Dystrophin Immunity in Duchenne's Muscular Dystrophy, and it addresses your recent work, Jerry, in transferring the mini-dystrophin gene into some boys who have Duchenne dystrophy. Can we start maybe with, you could tell us, what is a mini-dystrophin gene, and why did you use it and not a full-length dystrophin?
In our attempt to transfer genes to muscle, the most effective way is to use a virus called adeno-associated virus. This virus has a limited, what we call, packaging capacity. It can only hold so much. We take the viral genes out and put the gene of interest in, but the gene of interest can only be a certain size. And the DMD gene, the naturally occurring DMD gene, is too large. So we have to whittle it down or pare it down so that it fits inside the adeno-associated virus, or AAV. And by doing that, we can produce dystrophin. And we have to be sure in preclinical work, in other words, in mouse studies or dog studies, that this small dystrophin or this mini dystrophin will adequately produce significant function of the dystrophin gene. And the mini dystrophin gene that we transferred has been proven to be effective, let's say, in the MDX mouse, the mouse model for muscular dystrophy.
And I guess there are examples of this phenomenon in some ways in the natural world. Aren't there some Becker muscular dystrophy patients who have, in their own version, sort of miniaturized, truncated, internally truncated genes as well that have pretty good function?
Well, in fact, you hit on the subject perfectly in that these small dystrophins or these mini dystrophins were actually derived conceptually from the Becker muscular dystrophy patients who exhibited this. They had small dystrophins, truncated dystrophins, but functioned very well. In fact, one of the major examples is a patient who had nearly 50% of the dystrophin gene that was deleted, but yet walked until he was 61 years old. And the whole concept of mini dystrophins were derived from this patient.
So you mentioned adeno-associated virus, and some of our listeners might know there's many types of adeno-associated viruses. Could you describe just a little bit about that and a little bit? In this paper, you use what's called AAV. It's type 2.5. What does that mean?
Well, there are more than 100 different types, or what we call serotypes, of adeno-associated virus. And the serotypes are determined by small changes in the capsule, or the capsid as it's officially termed, the capsid that surrounds the internal part of the virus. And the most common serotypes are AAV 1, 2, 6, 8, and 9. These are the ones that go into clinical trial most often. Now, before we started this trial, the only one that had actually ever been tested in a clinical trial was AAV2. And so what we did was do a very slight change on the AAV capsid and incorporate some of the features of AAV1, but not so that it would be a complete conversion to AAV1. So it was partial AAV2 and partial AAV1, and we called it 2.5. And the reason for doing it this way is that AAV2 had been previously tested and we knew it was safe. And by only putting a small amount of AAV1, we could use this under the same safety criteria as AAV2. And yet AAV1 has features that allow it to express long term in muscle. So we had kind of the best of all worlds. A little bit of AAV1 on top of a whole lot of AAV2 and called it AAV25.
So the challenge is, after you put this virus into the body, of course, in your paper is largely about immune responses. What sort of immune responses did you expect and can you look for in a trial like this?
Well, I think that from all of the literature that had ever been published on adeno-associated virus, most of what we anticipated was the possibility that the body would react to the virus. After all, it is a natural phenomenon. Whenever we get a cold or get an upper respiratory infection, our body makes antibody and protects us against the virus. So that was kind of the expected phenomenon, but it has been shown that this initial response to the virus, the same as you would get if you were infected with some naturally occurring infection, wouldn't impair gene expression, at least in all probability. And so we were expecting a mild response to the virus, but nothing that would prevent gene expression. What was new about the article, and the reason it received attention in the New England Journal, is that for the first time we had or encountered a response to the gene that we put in, the small dystrophin gene. When we put this small dystrophin gene in, the surprise was that the product from the gene turned out to be immunogenic or aroused an immune response. And there were two conditions that caused this arousal. The first one was related actually to the patient's own mutation. Whenever the small dystrophin was expressed in a region that the patient's own gene was deleted and produced protein, we had an immunogenic response. And in a sense, that's very logical. But since it had never been described before, it was really unanticipated in our work. The second immunogenic response was one that was totally a surprise, a complete surprise in the field. And it would be great to have a blackboard to explain this, but I'll do the best I can, at least with graphic words. What happens in normal muscular dystrophy or Duchenne dystrophy is that we have what we call revertant fibers. We may have a mutation, but the gene is so big that it actually allows for a second mutation to come in and for the gene to express off of this second mutation. And if the body's never seen this new dystrophin that's produced from this second mutation, it can cause an immune response. And that's in fact what we found. We found that we put in the gene, it made a protein, and the body had also previously made a protein that it had developed antibodies to or an immune response to. So there was a clash here. Our gene expressed this new protein. The body had previously produced a protein that was immunogenic, and we lost gene expression.
And that, in your paper, you mentioned that this is related to T cells that maintain this memory. That's the category of cells that really help maintain this response. Is that right?
That's right. Well, there are two types of immune responses that we see under immunogenic conditions. One is produces an antibody response, and antibody responses are related to B cells and plasma cells. And then there are the type of cellular response that actually attacks tissue or attacks, in this case, muscle fibers. And these can be measured within the muscle, or we can actually measure them in the blood. And in fact, we did in this case measure T cells that were aroused by this immune response in the patient's blood, and we could show specifically and very precisely that the immune response was related within T cells to the area of the revertin fibers that expressed, and that area of revertin fibers was matched exactly what the patient's transgene expressed when we put it in. So we really had created a major dilemma here for the patient. We put in a gene, made a protein. The body had already produced T cells to this, and obviously then we lost gene expression from these T cells that were in place.
And these responses were seen in two of the six boys that you injected. Six boys had the transplant. Two had slightly variant responses, but they had these types of responses. This clearly raises some challenges, doesn't it, for the idea of gene therapy? What does it teach us about these challenges?
Well, it teaches us a way to move forward, and this is what I've emphasized to our patients who participated in the study. It was really a great revelation because now we have a clear path to move forward. We know, one, that when we put in a transgene, we cannot express that transgene in an area of the patient's deletion. So we can plan ahead. We can look at the patient's mutation and know which patients would most likely be responsive to the treatment. The second thing we can do is, before we ever do any gene therapy, we can test the patient for these immunoreactive T cells. And if they have those and they're present in their blood, we know that that patient would not be responsive to gene therapy. So this was a very important study. And again, I emphasize that that's why it was published in the New England Journal in a very prominent place, to help other people, other investigators, when they're planning their gene therapy studies, to avoid the same mistakes as we learned from this study.
I should probably point out to our listeners that one of the projects in our Wellstone Center is, in fact, a survey of these immune responses in boys, and point out to listeners that patients who wish to participate in those studies are welcome to contact us in the clinic or contact one of our study coordinators.
And I think I want to emphasize how important that is, because the better we can characterize these in patients, the more we know about their receptivity potentially to gene changing or gene transforming types of treatment, and so it would benefit patients to have this testing and know the results of this testing, and it would make them better candidates for treatment in the future.
So, besides those ongoing studies, what are the next steps in your view to moving forward for gene therapy?
Well, we've been working on this for quite a while, and the most important thing in a conceptual way is to put the gene in to reach as many muscles as possible. And in reaching as many muscles as possible, we appreciate, as other investigators do, that the most efficient way to transfer the gene to patients is to reach as many muscles as possible, and by that would be by virtue of the circulation. What I haven't mentioned up to this point is that all the gene therapy studies that have been done so far for muscular dystrophy have involved direct muscle injection. You take the gene, put it in a syringe, and inject it into one muscle. Well, that's a very important phase of the study because it shows us whether it'll work or not. But if we wanted to really help the patient, we would get it to as many muscles in the limb as possible. And that requires putting it in the circulation. And we've been studying this for the past several years and found that we can deliver the gene effectively by putting it through the major artery to the leg. Other investigators are using a similar approach, but putting the gene in the veins of the leg. So one is, these two approaches seem to both be working well. We don't have direct comparison which works better, but the idea is the same for both. We deliver the gene to as many muscles as possible, and then we use what we learned from the article that's published in the New England Journal. We pretest the patients for T-cell response to revertin fibers. We know not to express the small dystrophin or the mini dystrophin in the region of the patient's deletion, so we should really have a happy marriage at the end, getting the gene to as many muscles as possible and yet avoiding the flaws of pre-existing immunity.
Jerry, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today and remind our listeners that they can access the abstract of the New England Journal article on our website. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Gene Therapy at Nationwide Children's Hospital. You can find out more about the Muscular Dystrophy Program and about ongoing clinical trials at Nationwide Children's at our website, nationwidechildrens.org/muscular-dystrophy-podcast. You'll also find, as I said, a link to the published abstract of the study we discussed today. Thank you for joining us.